You want Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's gets it. We checked the calendar, and Christmas is coming early. $99 is all you need to grab your favorite select 7-foot pre-lit artificial Christmas tree for the holiday season. And don't sweat what gifts to get Dad, because we've got up to 40% off select tools and accessories. That's how Lowe's celebrates Black Friday early. Selection varies by location while supplies last.
CODA salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, CODA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, CODA Mainstream, or CODA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at CODA.com.
This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Karen,
yes.
Thanks.
All right, sir, I placed before you a document. You familiarize yourself with that and then tell the jury if you recognize what it depicts.
I have a call log that says 20888 with no name at 623. That's incomplete because there should be three other records accounting for this call.
Okay, but that record itself reflects a call from Jennifer McCabe's phone at 623 and 0 seconds.
I don't know. There's no number on here, so I can't tell. It just says it's a call log with one call that's not answered at 623 in the morning with doesn't say who it's from or who it's going to.
Okay.
It also is incomplete because there should be two other records with this. This is from the call history store data wall. Marked as deleted.
It's marked as deleted. Does it give a duration?
It just says duration 0 seconds.
Okay. And does it reflect that it was unanswered?
Yes.
Okay. May I have that marked for identification, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
Did you investigate whether a call was placed from Jennifer McCabe to Brian Albert at 6:23 in the morning and 0 seconds?
I didn't look at any specific calls that morning. I created a sell-by report. That's about it.
Did you ask either Ian Whiffen or Jessica Hyde to look into that issue?
Objection.
Sustained.
You would agree with me that that call and the record of that deletion of that call is nowhere in your April 24th report, correct?
I believe it's in my May 9th report.
All right, but I asked you about your April 24th report, sir.
I didn't address anything regarding phone calls in my April 24th report.
All right, now going back to when you began your examination around May 4th of 2022, you were looking for information on, did you look on Jennifer McCabe's phone back in May 4th of 2022?
Did I physically open the phone or did it?
Did you review the data at all?
On the cell phone itself or from the report?
Either way.
No, her phone was returned to her and then we had the extraction. I did not utilize the extraction at all.
You never included the two searches that we discussed, how long T.I. die in CIKD and how long to die in cold in the full file system extraction that was turned over to the defense, did you?
They were included.
Well, page 6 of your April 24th, 2023 report goes on to state that when you switch to a new version of Celebrite, and
sorry,
that dropped out.
Yeah, it was the phone call, the power log.
Page 6 of your April 24th, 2023 report says that when you switch to a new version of Celebrite Physical Analyzer, which was version 7.61.0.12, you found an artifact from the browser state DB wall file for a Google search of Hoss Long to die in cold at 2:27 and 40 seconds, correct?
Yes.
May I approach?
Yes.
So Cooper, I'm placing before you what has been marked as Exhibit 99. Do you recognize that?
Yes.
And what is that?
It's the searches that were done at 623 regarding the misspelled how long to die in the cold.
Okay, and it's actually Hoss Long to die in cold,
yes.
Right? HOS?
Yep, that was...
Yeah. That was marked by Cellebrite as deleted, was it not?
Yes.
All right. And your April 24th, 2023 report goes on to mention two deleted calls to Jen McCabe's sister, Nicole, who was saved as Coco in her phone, correct?
I'd have to see it, but I believe so.
May I approach?
Yes.
Thank you.
Showing you what's been marked Y for identification. If you familiarize yourself with that and look up at me when you're done.
Okay.
Does that show the two deleted calls to Jen McCabe's sister, Nicole, who was saved as Coco in her phone?
I don't know who it's coming from, but it does say it's going to Coco and then again coming from wall files, correct?
All right. And your report doesn't mention it, but what was the duration of those two calls according to that log?
On this sheet here, it says 9 seconds for the first one and then 7 seconds for the other.
All right. And those calls, both of them, which actually had durations, were marked answered by Cellebrite, correct?
Yes.
May I offer that, Your Honor?
Do you need both?
I believe it's already in, but
I'm sorry?
I believe it's already.
Why for identification?
No, I understand. I believe Ms. McCabe's phone calls and all of that is already marked as an exhibit months ago.
Your Honor, I don't think there's any harm in marking this, and I want to display it.
All right, I'll let you display it. If it's already in evidence, I just don't want duplicates.
I understand.
So what I'll do is I'll let you display it, and then, Mr. Lally, at some point you find where this is, and we will mark this like A to whatever
okay.
The whatever the number is.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Bates, if you could display what was marked Y for identification. Yeah. And, Trooper, with regard to what is displayed on the screen now, is that consistent with what I had just handed to you?
Yes, it is.
And with regard to the first entry there, you had stated that it doesn't say, you said it doesn't say who was making the call. Was that your testimony?
Yes, it just says right here.
Yep.
I'm guessing that's the last four of the number, because right. The rest is blurred, and then, yeah, that's it.
Okay, and you know that 0204 last four digits, that is to somebody who was listed as Coco in the phone, correct?
I don't know any of these phone numbers or people.
But you previously testified these two calls were somebody who was named Coco in the phone.
Oh, yeah, from the sheet you gave me that shows it.
And the time of the first call was 6:07:42, is that right?
That's correct.
And testified that that's the one that had the duration of 9 seconds?
Yes.
Listed as answered?
Correct.
And deleted, correct?
Yes and no, and I can explain if you'd like.
Listed as deleted, is it not?
There's a reason why.
Is it listed as deleted?
It is, but there's a reason why.
With regard to the second call, that appears to be to the same number, or at least the same last four digits?
Yes.
And in the sheet in front of you, that's also Coco, correct?
Yes.
And that has a timestamp of 6:08:17, is that correct?
That is correct.
That also has a duration, and that's of 7 seconds?
Yes.
Also listed as answered?
Yes.
And also marked deleted, correct?
Yes, and there's a reason.
And are you aware that Ms. McCabe made other calls that morning, which were in fact marked unanswered by Cellebrite?
Again, I'd have to see what you're referring to.
So as you testify to here today, you have no memory as to whether or not she made a number of other calls that were marked deleted, sir?
There are a number of calls that morning. I have not memorized all of them.
And again, Your Honor, if I may approach to show something that's on a computer screen.
Thank you. Got it.
Okay. I've placed before you what appears to be a PDF document on a computer screen. If you familiarize yourself with it and look up at me when you're done.
Okay.
What does that appear to be, sir?
An incomplete PDF of the call logs from whoever's call log this is.
Oh, and do you see in that PDF that there were a number of calls that were marked unanswered by Cellebrite?
Again, I can't testify to any of this because I can't confirm that where this data came from. There's no source file. This is completely, it's incomplete. So I do see what you're talking about in that column, but I don't know what any of this data is from or who made this.
Your name on it?
At the very top, it would show my name no matter what because I created the UFED and the extraction. I did not create this PDF.
So the answer to my question is your name is on that document, right?
It is, but I didn't create it.
Right. And with regard to the calls that were marked unanswered, would you agree with me that Cellebrite had them with durations of 0 seconds?
Objection.
Can you agree with that? Can you answer that question? Ken, please answer it.
With the data given here, I can't because, like I said, I don't know where they got this from, Your Honor.
So who created that document?
I don't know.
So are you testifying that nobody in law enforcement created that document or nobody, no forensic expert for the Commonwealth created that document?
I created the extraction and made a UFED reader report, which is basically a portable Cellebrite version that I use at the office. I gave that to defense. I don't know who created this PDF version of data with specific things. I did not.
Was it Michael Proctor?
No. As I said, I was the only one that created any Cellebrite-related reports in this case.
Well, I'd like to ask you some questions about my client's cell phone, sir.
Okay.
On Tuesday, when Mr. Lally was questioning you, he had you point out and read some text messages that were on her phone between John O'Keefe and her, correct?
Those messages were taken from John O'Keefe's phone.
Okay. Would you agree with me when he was pointing out those text messages to you, he skipped about 40 pages of messages at one point?
I don't know. I believe their text messages went back all the way to 2020 or something ridiculous,
right,
in his phone.
He started reading them and he skipped ahead about 40 pages, did he not?
I have no idea.
Michael Proctor seized my client's phone on January 29th of 2022. Did he not?
He did.
And you would agree with me that certainly as of 6 days later, your February 4th report, you had not yet been able to access the content of the phone, correct?
That's not true.
At some point, you were able to access the content of the phone, correct?
Yes, on January 31st.
Of 2022?
Yes.
All right. You later became aware that Michael Proctor was searching through my client's phone in August of 2022, correct?
The actual device itself or the extraction report?
Either one, sir.
I have, I'm sorry, Ms. Reed's phone?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we didn't...
Did John O'Keefe's phone?
Yes, that's why I was confused.
I apologize.
Sorry.
I'm not trying to confuse you.
Yeah.
With regard
sure.
to my client's phone, which is where we started,
yeah.
You're aware that Michael Proctor was searching through her phone in August of 2022.
Of the extraction report created, correct.
Were you made aware that on January 1st of 2023, the defense requested a full forensic image of Karen Reed's phone, which was in your possession?
I don't know the date, but a request was made for the phone extraction, yes.
And have you seen a forensic image or Cellebrite a report of the forensic image from Karen Reed's phone?
The redacted version that I received back from the AG's office, yes.
Okay. And would you please tell the jurors how many phone calls were deleted from Karen Reed's phone from January 29th of 2022?
None.
And if you'd please tell the jurors, other than to John O'Keefe, to whom did Ms. Reed place phone calls between 12 a.m. and 4:30 a.m. on January 29th?
Her parents twice. There are two or three times there's calls to her parents and that's it.
And how many Google searches did she do from 12 a.m. until 5 a.m.?
I don't believe there were any.
And how many Google searches were deleted by Ms. Reed at any point on January 29th of 2022?
I can't speak to that because we got a redacted version of the report, so I don't know what was taken out by the AG's office. I don't know what files they went in to remove, so I only have what I was given.
But leaving that aside, sir, yeah. With regard to all of the data that was provided you, mm-hmm. How many Google searches did you see or find that Karen Reed deleted from January 29th of 2022?
A few.
During what time period?
The afternoon. But again, there was artifacts that I found that weren't date and time stamped, and there were some that were with corresponding timestamps, but I can't say for sure when that was done.
Okay. But you saw no deleted calls, correct?
No, not that I know of.
All right. I may have a moment?
Yes.
Sorry.
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Chipper Greeno, you asked about your qualifications as far as certifications that you received in prior trainings, correct?
Yes.
What are some of the areas that you received certifications?
Cell phone report creation, extraction, cell phone repair, the Berlin Motor Vehicle Forensics, advanced database. A class called CASA, but it's a Cellebrite-made class that goes deeper into the database searching, SQLite programming to write code to do your own searches, things of that nature.
Now, at any point in time, did Trooper Proctor ever tell you that he retrieved Mr. O'Keefe's cell phone directly from 34 Fairview Road?
No, he didn't.
Is it your understanding, or subsequently did you learn that Kerry Roberts actually recovered the phone from under Mr. O'Keefe's body, from the grass under his body at 34 Fairview Road when he was placed onto a scoop stretcher?
I don't know who recovered the phone that morning, but I know.
I'll allow it.
I don't know.
Your answer is you don't know who recovered it?
No, I just know that it was found underneath his body and then taken to Canton PD.
Now, with regard to that, as far as the location data post 6:15 a.m., what, if anything, did you observe in reference to that?
There was some intermittent native locations. It showed at the Canton PD. It's there for a handful of different points, and then it shows it back at our office when I put it into the digital evidence lab powered on to plug in.
You received the phone from Trooper Proctor. Was that either in airplane mode or a Faraday back?
I don't remember offhand.
There were no locations or GPS locations that you observed from the phone from that approximately 11 something a.m. until you retrieved it or received it, excuse me, at 7:30 p.m. on the 29th?
There's, like I said, there's only the handful that showed it at Canton PD and then when it's back at the office that night. And then if it wasn't in airplane mode, there would have been something I would have done. So I don't remember if Proctor did it before he gave it to me or if I did it after.
Now, the other troopers in your unit, in the detective unit with the North DA's office, are they as well versed on cell phone extraction and cell phone data as you are?
No.
And so again, how many people within your specific unit actually perform data extractions or forensic analysis of cell phones?
Myself, Trooper Connor Keefe, and everyone has been trained in how to use Cellbrite and to do these extractions. They all just sort of dump them on my desk and say, do this phone for me. So.
Now, as far as what you provide to one of the investigating troopers, such as Trooper Brock, can you explain to the jury sort of that process of how you, what if any differences there are between what you're looking at as far as the device when you're extracting the information and what you provide to the...
So when I plug into GrayKey or Cellbrite or whatever tool I'm using to extract the data, it creates that zip file and then I open it up in Cellbrite or Axiom. The guys are only trained in Cellbrite, so that's what I open the extractions initially in for them. If there's something that we find that they don't understand and that I want to look more into, I'll load into Axiom as well. But that's normally how it would go.
Now, is there any way from the version or the extraction that you buy to the trooper, is there any way for that or any trooper to change or manipulate that data from what is initially contained on the phone?
In essence, you could, but you'd have to go in. So once I create like that UFED reader, which is the portable case, you would have to go into the folders and then delete stuff, which would change all of the data. And then when I would load it up later, it probably wouldn't work right. But that's why we save the encrypted extraction onto the server. So anything ever messes up, we can go back and reload it and I can create whatever reports I need with it.
And so from your view of the data in the phone, this case, what if anything did you observe in regard to any manipulation of data or deletion of data or removal of data? What you observe?
From the encrypted files that we have, none. And then we didn't have passcodes for the phones for John O'Keefe's until the 31st. And then again, for Ms. Reed's until, August, once the program was able to open it.
Now, you were asked some questions about Mr. Green's affidavit. Following your review of Mr. Green's affidavit, what, if any, steps did you take in relation to what was indicated in there?
So as I said, I didn't really go through the phones much when we first got them. I don't know everything about the cases the investigators do. So I got his report and I went through it and basically just went step by step. So he says this happened. I went to confirm it. If it didn't, then I need to find out why he was either incorrect or slightly off and either just completely wrong or just misinterpreted the data. And that was it.
And in addition to yourself going through some of the data, who, if anyone, did you contact to assist or to also, in addition, go through the data specifically as it related to the searches from his case?
So initially, when I first found it, I spoke with Chris Vance of Magna Forensics. He's their head technical guy for Axiom. He's like their forensic specialist. So he was at the cybercrime conference. I brought him.
I'm going to allow this.
I brought the extraction there and I said, hey, this is what I'm seeing. This is what it parsed out. Why are we seeing it marked this way? And he goes, well, first off, you have to look exactly where it's coming from, the browser state.
So I'll strike that last part, what he told you.
Okay. Reviewing the data, we saw that it came from the browser state DB file and .wall file, I should say, at the end. So it set off a lot of red flags. And then from there, we contacted Cellbrite and ultimately Jessica Hyde.
And ultimately, Mr. Whiffen as well, is that correct?
Yes, he came in after Cellbrite. I had reached out to them and they escalated it up and he reached out to us to help us.
Now, with respect to the health data that you were asked about, again, if you could explain to the jury when something in there in the health data says steps, what exactly does steps mean?
As I said before, the phone is seeing movement. Doesn't necessarily mean you're taking steps. If you have the iWatch paired to it, you're going to get a greater level of accuracy. And I would be more apt to believe that steps are being taken because it's going to also bring your heart rate. So if you're taking a large amount of steps, it's going to correspond.
Now, you were asked a lot of questions on cross-examination about just the health data and just the health data. Why is it that you would look beyond just the health data?
Well, you have the GPS points as well as the health data. We're trying to look at everything together as a whole. You take one artifact and say, well, this means this, but you could have five others that disclaim it. So that's why we look at all of this stuff.
Now, from that same information as far as the GPS data, that indicated that Mr. O'Keefe's phone arrived at 34 Fairview Road at 12:25 a.m., correct?
Yes.
Now, as far as the clocks or the three different clocks that was handed to you that's now been marked for identification, you indicated that those were not accurate. Is that correct?
Well, the file that it's coming from is not accurate. So it came from a power log file that's the database it pulled from. So that's telling you the power of the phone. So when I looked at that, that also shows the battery level. And that's how I was able to show that, or see, I should say, that John O'Keefe's phone never turned off. It dropped down to about 17% battery level from being under his body. It was actually saved it from dying overnight. And it also shows the timestamps of when it gets plugged in and as it goes up. That has three different timestamps. That's what that is from. That is not when Waze has started. That is not when the address is put in. That is strictly for the power log. Nothing to do with anything else.
And so, again, sort of to that point, what if any connection to those timestamps in the the document marked for identification Mr. Unetti showed you, what if any relationship does that have to the timestamps obtained within either Waze, GPS native locations, or anything else that you were testifying about?
It's literally showing that Waze has been opened and that it's pulling power from the phone, and that is it. It is nothing else.
Now, with regard to, you were asked some questions about Ms. McCabe signing consent for extraction on February 2nd, 2022, correct?
Yes.
And Ms. Kerry Roberts, she did the same on the same date. Is that also correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Now, the entirety of those extractions from both Ms. McCabe's phone and Ms. Roberts' phones, those were both provided well in advance of the dates the counsel was indicating, correct?
That is correct.
Now, in regard to Cellebrite extraction, in regard to Ms. Green's affidavit, Cellebrite has periodically updates the versions of their software, correct?
That is correct.
And if you could speak a bit about sort of the update in those versions and how that pertains to this case, and specifically Ms. McCabe's search.
So the initial report that I created with version 7.53 did not have that item to be able to be taken out. I was told by Cellebrite that 7.55 was the version that was enabled. Mr. Green used version 7.61, so that's why it presented itself then.
Can I just stop you there for 1 second? The version that Mr. Green used, was that available at the time that you did the initial extraction?
No, it wasn't available for like a year later. It was like 10 upgrades later.
Sorry, sir, continue.
So again, he did the extraction, he looked at it, finds this artifact that's parsed out, and then I had to go back in and scramble to say, well, why didn't I see it the first time when that report, why didn't it pull? So I reloaded the 7.53 version. It's not there. And then when I loaded into 7.61, it is. So there's just an issue with the software at the time.
So, sir, with regard to those Google searches, what, if any, opinion did you have as to when those searches were conducted?
When Ms. McCabe told us that it happened at 6:23 and 6:24, and then there was a third one later at 10:35 that, again, if she reopened that browser window, it's going to reload the search. And then that was it. Those are the three times that I saw in the phone extraction that were real searches.
And why is it that you, it's your opinion that they occurred at 6:23 and 6:24 in the morning and not 2:27?
Well, it's physically impossible to search two things at once. Her phone, she's searching the daughter's basketball at 2:27, and then she's searching It's Raining Men and a few other things on her phone, listening to music. And I think then she goes to bed a few hours later. So I was told as the defendant asked her to search for those terms, that's when we believe that they were done.
Now, as far as wall files or write-ahead log, having things listed as deleted, if you could just speak a little bit more about that, as far as why would something be listed as deleted in a wall file, and what does that mean?
Again, the user has no input on how a wall file is deleted. It's an automated thing that the database does to clean up. Just it auto deletes after either programs are closed, it reaches a max data allotment for that page. That is it.
And that would include any sort of call log history that was contained in the write-ahead log or the wall file as well?
That is correct.
And so what, if any, opinion do you have as to those phone calls that you're showing in relation to the contact listed in Ms. Davis' phone at Coco, as far as whether or not they were user deleted?
Well, again, what the defense showed me was limited thing. I know there should be two other locations that phone call was listed from looking at it myself. So I don't know why they gave me just two deleted things, but there should be other spots in the database where that phone call was there. So I don't believe that it was user initiated. It was phone initiated.
And that's in reference to the write-ahead log, sort of first in, first out, as far as data that comes in. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, again, as far as your unit was concerned, you were the only one who created any Cellebrite reports in relation to any of the phones. In this case, with the exception of the defendant's phone that was created by the Attorney General's office following their extraction of privileged material, correct?
Objection. So objection is sustained as to the form. This seems a good place to stop. So jurors, we'll take the luncheon break. There is a chance that we may be able to go a full day tomorrow, so just think about that at lunch. If there's any emergency that event you being able to go a full day.
Sure, it's closing your notebooks, leaving on the chairs. All right, well, all right. See
you. Yeah, so Mac apps, your next one, no problem. Chris. That's a need. No problem.
You are muted.
Thank you. Please be seated. Close the session.
All right, so jurors, when we were doing scheduling, and I know scheduling has changed a lot in this case, my main goal is to get this case to you folks by next week, when we all want this to you by next week. So originally on the 21st, we were either going to do a whole day, and then we couldn't do an all whole day, and it was all of this back and forth, and it was a half a day, and it was because I had something scheduled in this courthouse that was not going to be continued. Forces that we weren't aware of, it is going to be tomorrow. So in light of that, that I would like us, we'll be doing a whole day. I understand that for one of you, it land on an earlier start to the weekend or a vacation day or something from the afternoon on. But really, all I'm asking of you is to go from instead of a 1 o'clock stop to a 4 o'clock stop. And where I guess 14 of you are able to do that, we're going to die. So tomorrow will be a full day. I don't know who I'm inconveniencing, but I apologize. Because when I said emergency, an early start, the weekend's not. All right, could we call the witness back, please?
Group of same things, be mindful of this.
Thank you. Sorry. No, what you get.
All right, Mr. Lally.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
So with reference to this case, this investigation, who, if anyone besides you, created any Cellbrite reports or extractions from any of the phones involved?
Other than the AG's office, it was just myself.
And now you had mentioned that there was some deleted material from the defendant's phone from the afternoon of January 29th, 2022. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And what was that?
There were some search items that were not there in the phone, but found cookies related to said searches and websites visited.
So as far as search terms or web history, were those the areas that were deleted?
Yes, that's correct.
I have nothing further.
Okay.
Nothing further.
Thank you. Okay. So we brought you back for that, Trooper. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Your next witness, Mr. Lally.
Yes, Your Honor. The Commonwealth called Dr. Renee Stonebridge to the stand.
Okay.
Please watch a step basic
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you shall give to the court and the jury in the matter now pending shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Thank you. So once you sit, I'm going to tell you that you have to keep your voice up. We want to keep our air conditioning on, so just if you'd speak loudly into the microphone, that would be great.
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Lally.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Could you please state your name and spell your last name?
Yes, my name is Renee Stonebridge, last name Stonebridge, S-T-O-N-E-B-R-I-D-G-E.
And what do you do for work?
I am employed through the Chief Medical Examiner's Office at Boston as Director of Cardiac and Neuropathology and Medical Examiner.
Now, if I could ask you just a few questions about sort of your educational and work history background, if that's all right.
Yes.
Starting with your bachelor's degree, where did you go and what, if any, area did you receive a degree in?
So I went to SUNY at Stony Brook in New York. I was a double major in biology and Germanic languages and literature. I graduated with a bachelor's of science degree. After that, I went to the American University of Antigua for medical school, and I graduated with honors, magna cum laude. After that, I did a four-year combined anatomic and clinical pathology residency program at NYU Winthrop Hospital in Long Island, New York. After that, I did a one-year forensic pathology fellowship at the Boston office of the Chief Medical Examiner. And after that, I did a two-year neuropathology fellowship program through Brown University at Rhode Island Hospital.
And doctor, are you board certified?
Yes, I am board certified in anatomic pathology, clinical pathology, forensic pathology, and neuropathology.
And if you could just explain to the jury a little bit about what is board certified mean?
Board certification means that every medical specialty has their own board. So for example, the American Board of Pathology dictates whether or not you can be board certified based on certain criteria. So you have to meet certain criteria, meaning that you have to complete a certain number of surgical specimens, a certain number of autopsies. And then once you meet that criteria, you can take an exam, which if you pass, leads to your board certification.
Now, if I could ask you just a couple, and your board certification is up to date at this point, is that correct?
Yes.
In each of those areas that you just spoke of?
Yes.
Now, if I could ask you some general terms as far as if you could define them for the jury. First of all, what is pathology in a general?
Pathology is essentially the study of any sort of disease or abnormal state of the body tissues. So anything that can go wrong in the body, in any of the body systems, is essentially the study of pathology.
And now starting with anatomic pathology, what is anatomic pathology more specifically?
Anatomic pathology consists of the study of surgical specimens. So for example, if someone goes to the hospital to have a tumor removed, that specimen will go to pathology. The pathologist will look at it, cut it, look at specimens under the microscope, order any ancillary tests if necessary, and then make a diagnosis, which is then conveyed to the clinician. An anatomic pathology also consists of cytopathology, which is looking at individual cells. and then it also consists of autopsy pathology.
And as far as clinical pathology, what is that?
Clinical pathology is anything that is lab-related in pathology. So if you have to get blood drawn and then the results come back, that is clinical pathology. If there's any sort of blood work that needs to be done, for example, if you're going to have a surgery and they have to cross-match and type you in case of a blood transfusion, that's considered clinical pathology. Also, microbiology, so anything infectious. So essentially anything that goes through a lab is clinical pathology.
And what is forensic pathology?
Forensic pathology is the study of autopsies in a medical legal sense. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's always going to be something that is legal. Sometimes it may be just a person who has not seen a doctor in many years, dies at home. There's no physician that is willing to sign a death certificate. So we work on those types of cases, plus anything that is non-natural.
Now, neuropathology, what is that?
Neuropathology is the study of the brain, spinal cord, eyes, muscles, and nerves.
And if you could, just again, in general terms, as far as casework is concerned, related to your work as a director of the neuropathology, can you explain to the jury sort of what it is that you do with respect to neuropathology?
Yes. So my job primarily entails me to be a consultant for the medical examiners. So the medical examiners have a certain set of criteria that they follow in order to determine whether or not a brain needs to be saved for a neuropathologic analysis. So upon following that criteria, if the brain is saved, it gets put into formalin, which essentially fixes the brain so it firms it up, so it makes it easier to analyze. So after the brain has been fixed, I usually let them fix about 2 weeks. Sometimes it could be a little more, a little less, depending on circumstances. I will then look at the brain, take photographs of it from all sides, and then cut the brain, take photographs, document any sort of abnormalities. And then if I feel the need to take sections to look at under the microscope, then I will take those sections. They will be processed through histology. I will look at the slides. Sometimes you may have to add in additional testing, for example, immunohistochemistry, to see if there's anything in particular that you cannot maybe diagnose solely on looking at the histology. And then once that is done, I will issue a report to the medical examiner, and then they use it in terms of determining their cause and manner of death, if necessary.
Now, as far as that formalin process, as far as the solution is concerned, is there a typical time period that the brain would have to be in that solution prior to you examining it or cutting it or any of those other things?
Usually about 2 weeks, give or take maybe a few days here and there, but I usually try to let them fix at least 10 days minimum.
And again, in general terms, with respect to the types of cases that are referred to you, what types of cases are typically referred to you?
So part of the criteria that we use is that any cases for children or babies under the age of 2 years, those always come to me. Also, if there is any cases that have blunt head trauma that may be suspicious or homicidal in nature, those will typically come to me as well. Some of the other cases may be just a difficult neuropathologic entity that a non-neuropath trained medical examiner may not be able to really diagnose. And then sometimes there's cases that are just surprise cases where the medical examiner opens up the head and they see something interesting or abnormal and they decide to save that case for me to look at further.
Now, with respect to the cases that you do see, at some point did you become involved in analysis or testing of a brain belonging to John O'Keefe?
Yes.
And who was the doctor that was medical examiner that made that referral in this case?
It was Dr. Irini Scordibello.
And with respect to your analysis here, obviously looked at the brain. What, if any, other sources of information did you review or did you look at in ultimately formulating your opinion in this case?
So at the time when I was able to cut the brain of Mr. O'Keefe, I had information that was relayed to us from our intake department. So when a case gets called into the medical examiner, it gets taken by the intake department and they're given kind of just a rough summary of the case. I also had the police report, I had the EMS report, I had the medical records from when Mr. O'Keefe was in the hospital. I also had medical records from with the primary care physician. I had autopsy photos, and I also had, I believe the, just refer to my notes here because I had a lot of notes. I also had the inventory and tracking sheets, which are notes created by the medical examiner, and the neuropath request itself.
Now, are you familiar with some terms in relation to injuries that you would observe as far as from a neuropathological perspective, as far as injuries being acute, subacute, or remote?
Yes.
And can you explain to the jury sort of what those are and what those mean?
So it depends on circumstances. Acute generally is something that happened within a very short time frame. So when I refer to something as being acute, I usually refer to that as something that's occurring from the time of an injury to maybe a day or so afterwards. As I said, it's variable dependent on circumstances. Subacute is something that has not happened within the last few minutes, few hours, maybe even a day, and maybe something that is now in the process of healing. And then chronic is usually something that has happened a while ago in the past. You may see some sort of evidence of some type of injury in a chronic state. You may also not see any evidence because it may have completely healed by that point.
And so from your analysis in this case, how would you characterize, how did you characterize, in your opinion, from everything that you reviewed as far as the injuries you observed in Mr. O'Keefe's brain?
The injuries I observed were acute injuries, meaning that they probably occurred minutes to hours.
Now, if I could turn your attention to your findings as far as when you conducted your analysis and your testing in this particular case, what, if anything, did you find as far as injuries to Mr. O'Keefe's brain?
So when I look at the brain, what I do is I look at all surfaces from all sides. And one of the things that I look for is anything grossly obvious, meaning anything I can look at the brain and see that there's something there that shouldn't be there. So one of the first things I noticed was a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And subarachnoid hemorrhage is something that occurs when you have bleeding within the leptomeninges. The leptomeninges are a very thin membrane that encase the brain and the spinal cord, and there should not be blood freely floating within the leptomeninges. So if you have a subarachnoid hemorrhage, most of the time the causes are either a ruptured aneurysm, which is something I would see upon cutting the brain, or some type of trauma. So that was the first finding.
Can I stop you there just for a second? Of those taking notes and for our court reporter, could you spell the type of hemorrhage and the membrane?
Yes. Subarachnoid is SUBARACHNOID. And leptomeninges, LEPTOMEN. INGES.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Now, with regard to anything related to the aneurysm that you indicated that you would have seen, what, if anything, did you see during the course of your review or testing or analysis of Mr. O'Keefe's brain?
So aneurysms are typically seen in the cerebral vessels that sit around the base of the brain. So there's something called the circle of Willis, which is the main arterial supply. It sits around the base of the brain, and it's kind of shaped like a circle that has vessels that come off that extend to other areas of the brain. So typically, if there is an aneurysm that is ruptured, it's going to be located somewhere in one of those vessels. So upon observing those vessels, I did not see any evidence of any aneurysm or any sort of natural disease state that might have led to a rupture in one of these vessels. Also, sometimes these vessels, since they do go deep into the brain, you may only see the rupture upon cutting the brain. And I did not see any evidence of any rupture of any of these vessels anywhere in the brain.
Now, as far as the subarachnoid hemorrhage that you observed, where was that located within the brain, and if you could?
So the subarachnoid hemorrhage was on the frontal poles, which is essentially right here in the front of the brain. So the frontal lobes obviously sit in the front, and then the poles are the very frontmost portion of the brain. So it was on the frontal poles. It was also on the left temporal pole. So the temporal region is right here in the temporal region, and because of the way that the temporal lobe is shaped, it kind of has a little loop right in the front, so it has a pole as well. So it was on the left temporal pole, and then it was also in the left lateral fissure. So you have a frontal pole here, you have the temporal lobe right here, and then the lateral fissure goes kind of in between the temporal and the frontal lobes. So you have the hemorrhage here, and then hemorrhage right there. So it's kind of all concentrated almost in one area, but then there was also hemorrhage coverage of the posterior surface of the right temporal as well, so on this side.
Now, doctor, I'm probably going to butcher this horribly, but as far as the bilateral uncci, are you familiar with that?
Yes. So the uncci are the medial portion of the temporal lobes. So the brain is essentially oriented in a way that each hemisphere, the right and left hemisphere, are the same. The uncci are the most inner portion of the temporal lobes. So the uncci sit just next to the brainstem. So if you have anything that causes herniation of these uncci, they start to push inwards onto the brainstem. So say this is the brainstem, here are the uncci, they start to push in. And because the brain is within the skull is hard, you have no room for any sort of expansion of the brain. If there is herniation, it will start to push in that area because the brainstem turns into the spinal cord and goes out of the skull through the foramen magnum. So you have this hole about this big or so at the base of the skull where the brainstem turns to the spinal cord, then comes out. So that's one of the only areas in which the brain can actually move because it's encased in the hard skull. So if you have herniation, it'll start to push and then push downwards.
Can I ask you to spell
UNCI? UNCI.
And with reference to this bilateral unci area, what, if any, herniation did you observe?
So when the unci herniate, it can be subtle. Sometimes if it's herniated enough, you may see hemorrhages in the brainstem. And this happens because this tissue is now pushing on the brainstem and it's essentially being compressed. So there was herniation noted and then there was hemorrhage within the brainstem.
Now, if I could ask you, doctor, just to be familiar with the term or medical term known as contusion.
Yes.
And can you explain just in general terms to the jury what you understand that term means?
So a contusion is essentially a bruise. It's blood that's coming out from a blood vessel. It's a blood vessel that has been broken in some way, and now there's blood coming out.
Now, you're also familiar with another term, part of that term, known as a punctate contusion?
Yes. So punctate is essentially just a way to describe the size of a contusion. When I say punctate, I mean something that's very, very tiny, almost just like a dot.
And with respect to punctate contusion, what, if anything, did you observe in Mr. O'Keefe's brain, and where was it located?
So there were punctate contusions in the frontal and temporal cortices. So frontal, once again, is the front portion right here. Temporal is kind of right behind it in this area. And the cortex is the gray matter of the brain. So it's a thin strip that kind of just goes around the brain. And then the white matter is underneath all that. So in traumatic injuries, you can see punctate contusions or even larger contusions in the cortex. It usually indicates that the brain has been pushed against something, which is now causing these little blood vessels to rupture, hence seeing the contusions because the blood is no longer contained in the blood vessels.
Now, doctor, with regard to the subarachnoid hemorrhage, is there anything that you're able to do as far as measuring that?
It's hard to measure because it's usually pretty vague. It's not usually something that is a well circumscribed, meaning I could say it starts here and ends here. A lot of times it's subarachnoid hemorrhage because it's sitting in this space that it's not supposed to be in. It can spread, so it may be thicker in one area, thinner in another. So you may have some that may appear just as a very faint hemorrhage, and then some that might be very thick, which you can physically measure. So I usually just give an area where it is and say it's here, it's there, because it's almost like measuring something that has blurred edges. You can't really get a completely accurate measurement.
And what, if anything, were you able to observe or measure with regard to the subarachnoid hemorrhage in the area of the left prefrontal lobe?
So it appeared thicker in that area, meaning that as opposed to it looking just like a faint red color that should not be that color, it was actually thick enough that it was obscuring the underlying brain parenchyma.
If I could turn your attention, doctor, just back for a moment to the punctate contusions that you were testifying about before. As far as your observations of those, was that one or more than one, or how many did you observe?
So there were multiple. There were multiple contusions to the point where it's not something that you can count. I mean, you could count it, but it would probably take a very long time. If it had been something like one or two, three, four, maybe a handful, it would probably be something I would say there are three here, four there, but there were so many that it didn't serve a purpose to count.
And the number of those, what, if any, significance did that have in regard to your analysis, your observation?
So given that there's multiple, it means that there's enough pressure in the brain, that there were many surfaces that were pressing on the bony prominences of the skull, which was leading to a lot of blood vessels rupturing, causing these contusions.
Now, I think you've talked a little bit, but just in general terms, if you could describe for the jury, what is a hemorrhage?
So a hemorrhage is essentially blood that's coming out from a vessel. So it's like a bruise. Hemorrhage, bruise, contusion, they're fairly similar. Some people use them interchangeably, but it's essentially blood that's no longer contained in a blood vessel.
When something is termed medically, based on your training experience, as a diffuse hemorrhage, what does that mean?
So diffuse means it's over a very large area. It's not something that's just a tiny little area. You could say, okay, I'm looking at this person's, let's say, liver, and there's a 2 by 2 centimeter hemorrhage sitting right there in the right lobe of the liver. Diffuse would mean there's hemorrhage throughout nearly the entirety of the liver.
Now, with regard to, you made a note as far as there being a diffuse hemorrhage within the pons, P-O-N-S, is that correct?
Yes.
Can you explain to the jury sort of what that means and where is that located?
So the pons is part of the brainstem. So the brainstem starts right in the middle of the brain, and you have the midbrain, the pons, the medulla, and then it turns into the spinal cord. So the pons is kind of in the middle of the brainstem. And when you have hemorrhage in the pons, in this circumstance, it was because there was the herniation of those onci, which began moving closer and closer towards the pons, pressing on it, causing hemorrhage, because now the tissue is compressed. The blood is not going to be able to flow in and out freely, therefore hemorrhage.
Now, with regard to the totality of what you reviewed in this case in regard to Mr. O'Keefe, do you form any opinions to a reasonable degree of medical certainty in regard to the injuries that you observed to Mr. O'Keefe's brain?
I was able to determine that these are acute traumatic injuries. I know that based on what I observed and in combination with the autopsy findings, that this is due to some type of trauma.
If I could ask, as far as you have certain findings as far as an intraventricular hemorrhage and occipital horns of the lateral vent, correct?
Yes.
If you could please explain to the jury what exactly does that mean?
Yes. So the ventricles are a almost like a tunnel system of the brain in which the cerebrospinal fluid flows through. So the cerebrospinal fluid serves as a fluid that nourishes the brain. It provides a flow of nutrients, oxygen, things like that. And it starts in the frontal portion of the brain, and then it goes backwards towards the occipital, which is the back. And it also flows downward through the brain stem and then into the spinal cord as well. So the occipital horns of the lateral ventricles are in the back of the head, and having hemorrhage in those areas, in any area of the ventricular system, is usually indicative of some type of trauma. So there should not be blood freely flowing within the ventricular system.
Now, Dr. Stonebridge, with regard to your findings, you mentioned that your findings were that the injuries were acute and that the injuries were the result of trauma, correct?
Yes.
What, if anything, can you say or can you opine as to the mechanism for those acute traumatic injuries?
It was something that required some type of force, given that there were skull fractures. I can't say what type of force or how much force, but it was definitely something that caused some type of force, which led to the skull fractures and then the subsequent brain findings.
And the brain findings in particular that you made, were those consistent with the fall?
They can be, yes.
Can they also be consistent with being struck by a vehicle and then going to the ground?
Yes, they can be.
Thank you, Doc. I have no further questions, Ron.
You're welcome.
Cross examination.
No questions, thank you.
You're welcome.
Great, doctor, thank you very much. You are all set.
Thank you.
Mindful to step down.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Lally, your next witness.
Yes, Your Honor, the Commonwealth called Dr. Irene Scordi-Bello to the stand.
Okay.
And Your Honor, as she's coming in, may we approach briefly?
Sure. So, Madam Court Reporter, what was previously marked SS for identification is now the next exhibit.
That would be exhibit 641.
Thank you. All right. So are you looking for my instruction now, Mr. Lally?
Yes, please, Your Honor.
All right. So, jurors, I gave you a similar instruction before about photographs. So the Commonwealth intends to introduce into evidence, through the next witness, certain photographs showing Mr. O'Keefe post-mortem. You'll have those photographs with you in connection with this case. I understand that they will be, some of them will be shown up on the screen, and that's why I want to sort of give you a warning that
that will happen. When they come to you as exhibits, they'll be placed in an envelope. You can, you know, look at them briefly. They'll be covered, is what I'm saying to you. So the photographs are not pleasant. They can be described as graphic. And I instruct you that your verdict must not in any way be influenced by the fact that these photographs will be unpleasant, perhaps sad and graphic. The defendant's entitled to a verdict based solely on the evidence and not one based on pity or sympathy for Mr. O'Keefe, which might be occasioned by the photographs. So please consider those photographs only as they draw your attention to a clinical, medical status or to the nature of Mr. O'Keefe's injury. Or to the nature of the incident itself. Okay. All right. Now your next witness, please, Mr. Lally.
Yes. Remain standing, please.
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you shall give to the court and the jury in the matter now pending shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, doctor. All right, Mr. Lally, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
Could you please state your name and spell your last name for the jury?
My name is Irini Scordibello. My last name is spelled S-C-O-R-D-I-B-E-L-L-O.
And how are you employed, ma'am?
I am employed as a medical examiner.
And for whom are you employed?
I'm employed by the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
And how long has it been that you've been a medical examiner for the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in Massachusetts?
I have been with OCME in Massachusetts since December of 2016.
Now, ma'am, if I could take you back and just ask you a few questions regarding your educational background, work history a little bit prior to working at the OCME in Massachusetts. If I could start with your undergraduate work, as far as where did you go and what, if anything, did you receive a degree?
I completed a bachelor's degree in microbiology at the University of California.
And after receiving that degree, where did you go from there?
I went on to the University of Miami, where I completed my doctorate degree in immunology. And following that, I moved up to New York City, where I went to medical school. I completed 4 years of medical school at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And following medical school, I completed 3 years of pathology residency at the Mount Sinai Hospital.
And then following your residency at Mount Sinai, where did you go there?
And from there, I went downtown in New York City, and I completed a one-year fellowship in forensic pathology at the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner for the City of New York.
And following that one-year fellowship there, where did you go?
I worked in New York City until 2016 when I moved here to Massachusetts.
Now, are you board certified?
Yes, I am.
What are you board certified in?
I'm board certified in anatomic pathology and forensic pathology.
And if you could explain to the jury just briefly, what does it mean to be board certified and sort of what is entailed in that process?
Board certification is actually a voluntary process that a physician decides to go through. It involves completing an accredited program in the specialty of choice. In my case, it was pathology and forensic pathology, and then completing a number of requirements as well as taking and successfully passing exams and then being able to say that you're board certified.
Is that certification at this time, is that up to date?
Yes.
Now, with regard to the time that you're working as a forensic pathologist, are there any organizations that you belong to in relation to your work in that field?
Yes, I am a member of the National Association of Medical Examiners.
And that's an acronym as far as name?
Name,
is that correct?
Yes.
Now, with respect to that time frame as well, what, if any, experience do you have in regard to teaching the areas related to your...
I have always been interested in teaching. I started teaching as a pathology resident, teaching other residents and medical students, and during my time in New York City, I enjoyed teaching medical students and residents. We had a very active education program in New York City, so I've always been involved with teaching both pathology and forensic pathology.
Now, to those terms themselves, if I could ask you briefly just to describe to the jury as far as pathology in general sense, what is pathology?
Pathology is a specialty of medicine, and pathology looks at disease processes and as well as trauma and the effect they have on the human body.
And what is forensic pathology?
Forensic pathology looks at disease processes and injuries in the human body and tries to determine the cause of death in deceased individuals.
And as far as anatomic pathology, what exactly?
Anatomic pathology, as opposed to clinical pathology, is has to do with any organ that is in the body versus clinical pathology that deals with fluids and blood analysis and things like that. So anatomic pathology, a lot of anatomic pathologists are surgical pathologists. That's another term that you will hear. These are pathologists in the hospital that look at tissues under the microscope, and they come to a diagnosis whether something is benign or malignant. And forensic pathology takes anatomic pathology to another step, to another level, by looking at the whole body and trying to determine the cause of death instead of organ specific. Instead of just looking at one organ, forensic pathology looks at the whole body.
Now, you're also familiar through your work and training experience in regard to forensic pathology with a term called autopsy.
Yes.
And is that something that typically you would do in the case of for your investigation and your analysis in regard to a pathological analysis when it came to a body or a patient that comes in?
Yes, an autopsy is a procedure that we do to determine the cause and manner of death.
And so, doctor, with respect to an autopsy, may be a term that's pretty well understood, but if you could explain in general terms, as far as when a body or a patient comes in to the OCME, as far as what is an autopsy, what is involved in it, and sort of what does that consist of?
Yes. When a case, a death is first reported to the medical examiner's office, we make a determination as to whether that death falls under our jurisdiction. Cases that fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner include all violent deaths, all deaths that are due to not natural causes, all accidents, intoxications, deaths of babies and children, and deaths in individuals that were not under the care of a physician when the death occurred. So once a case is accepted and it falls under our jurisdiction, it is given a numerical number, and then the body is transported from either the location of the death or the hospital to our facility. Our facilities, we have three facilities in the state of Massachusetts. Once the body comes to our facility, then there are a number of steps that are taken. The body is processed. What that means is that their pictures are taken, a weight is taken, a height is taken. Everything is input into our computer system, and then a determination is made as to whether an autopsy is required in order for us to determine the cause and manner of death. If the answer is yes, then we proceed with the autopsy.
Now, as far as an autopsy is concerned, there are two sort of primary components of that, as far as an external examination and an internal examination. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you describe to the jury, again, in general terms, sort of what the process is in reference to both external and internal?
Yes. So the autopsy or the post-mortem examination has two main parts. The first one is the external exam, and it is basically what it sounds like. We do a very thorough exam of the outside of the body. We document physical characteristics, eye color, hair color. We document any scars or tattoos that are maybe on the body. We take pictures. We make notes. We look for any signs of disease and any signs of injury. All that is, as I mentioned, documented. And once we're during the external examination, sometimes we will take evidence. We will collect hair and nails from the body if we think that that is necessary or warranted. And once the external examination is done, then we proceed to the internal examination. That involves making surgical type cuts on the body, what's known as the Y incision, that goes from shoulder to shoulder and down the middle of the body. And the organs of the neck, the chest, the abdomen are examined thoroughly, again, looking for and documenting signs of disease or signs of injury. We do the same thing with the head. The head is open, the brain is removed, and we document any disease or injury.
Now, turning your attention to January 31st, 2022, and you have occasion to perform an autopsy in regard to a patient or a body of John O'Keefe.
I did.
And do you recall which, you mentioned there were three different offices of the chief medical examiner within the state of Massachusetts, correct?
Yes, it was in the Cape Cod office.
Is that the office that you typically work out of?
No, that's not the office I typically work out of. My permanent position is in the Westfield office in Western Massachusetts. I was covering the office that day because we were short-staffed.
And in the reference to the autopsy that you formed with regard to Mr. O'Keefe, was that in conformity with what you're speaking about before, generally as far as how you conduct autopsy?
Yes.
Now, during the course of the autopsy that you performed in reference to Mr. O'Keefe, during the course of the external examination, what, if anything, did you note in reference to that external examination of Mr. O'Keefe?
First, I noted that there was evidence of medical intervention. Mr. O'Keefe's body was transported to our facility from the hospital, and he had evidence of attempted resuscitation. After I documented that, I proceeded to document some injuries that I saw on Mr. O'Keefe's body.
And before we turn to that, if I could just ask you a couple more general questions. You've made some mention earlier in your testimony as far as the cause and manner of death in general. That's two things that you're trying to determine during any sort of forensic pathological examination, correct?
Yes.
And what I'm going to ask you first is just in reference to manner. Can you describe for the jury sort of what are the different types of manner in death and how are they sort of classified from a perspective from your office?
Okay. Yes. So the manner of death are the circumstances that led to the cause of death. The cause of death being the disease or the injury that initiated the sequence that led to the fatal events. So the manner of death is circumstance dependent. There are five general manners of death or five umbrellas. The first one is natural. When we determine manner of death to be natural, it means that the death was caused exclusively by natural disease. That would be heart disease, liver disease, cancer, aging, Alzheimer's, dementia, etc. The second manner of death is accident. That means that the cause of death was due to an injury or due to an intoxication, either a physical injury or a chemical injury. But the circumstances show little or no evidence that that intoxication or that injury was intentional. So most motor vehicle accidents, most drug overdoses, most elderly falls are classified as accidents. The fatal outcome was not intentional. Homicide is a manner of death when there is injury inflicted by another person, but there is evidence that there was intent to cause fear, harm, or death to the other individual. And suicide is due to either an injury or an intoxication. And again, the circumstances and the evidence suggest or point strongly to the fact that that was a self-inflicted intentional act on behalf of the person with the intent to cause harm to themselves or cause death to themselves. So most hangings, intentional overdoses by prescription medications are classified as suicides. And then we have, one more manner that we call undetermined. Some jurisdictions, they call it could not be determined. That means that evidence pointing towards one set of circumstances or one manner is no more compelling than evidence pointing towards another manner of death. So if we don't have enough information to know whether something or to be able to determine the circumstances, then we are left with an undetermined manner of death.
Now, am I correct in stating that the cause of death is something that's more like a medical determination? Is that correct?
Yes, the cause.
So watch the leading questions, Mr. Riley. It's just a...
How would you characterize the determination that you make in regard to a cause of
death? The cause of death is based on my findings at the time of autopsy, along with any medical information that I'm may have on that deceased individual.
Now, as far as the manner of death, how are you making that?
The manner of death, as I mentioned, is circumstance dependent. I make that determination based on investigative information that is provided to me by law enforcement, by the people who did the investigation.
And what, if any, legal determination are you making as far as when you classify something as either of those five categories in a manner of death?
I am not making a legal determination. I'm making a medical determination.
And so as far as the medical determination of manner of death, when typically when I'm talking about something that could be ruled or listed as manner of death as acts, is that, what if any determination are you making as far as that is?
I'm making the determination that the information that I have either shows no evidence or very little evidence that the injury that led to the cause of death was intentional. So I don't have any information to suggest that that was an intentional act.
And am I correct in saying that routinely people charged with, say, motor vehicle homicides, it gets classified as a manner of death as acts, correct?
Objection.
Sustained.
May I approach, Your
Honor? Yes.
Doctor, I'm showing you the documents. I ask you to review with a couple of finishes.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
COTA salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at COTA.com/trip planner.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.